Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Democrat Joe Biden has been elected the 46th president of the United States, defeating incumbent President Donald Trump. Biden was projected as the winner of the election Saturday morning after winning Pennsylvania's 20 electoral votes. Trump hasn't conceded and vows to keep on fighting in the courts, claiming without providing evidence of widespread fraud. Biden supporters took to the streets across the country celebrating his victory. On today's program, we will open our phones and hear what you think on the Biden win. Our phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You could send an email. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Now, we don't often do this. I mean, we will have a guest here in just a moment. I'll talk about Dr. O'Connell. But this is an opportunity for you to share your thoughts on the election, not just what happened Saturday, the election overall, the whole election season. Where do you see, what do you want to see, I should say, a new President Biden doing after he takes office in January? Why do you think the results came out the way they did? Republicans doing much better than even expected, other than in the presidential race. A lot of questions. Your thoughts, 1-800-729-7532. With me is Dr. David O'Connell. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Dickinson College. He's the author of the book, God Wills It, Presidents and the Political Use of Religion, and his research and writing has been published in, or is forthcoming in, Presidential Studies Quarterly, Politics and Religion, Political Science Quarterly, and White House Studies. Dr. O'Connell, thanks for being with us this morning.
Morning, Scott. Thanks for having me on the program again.
Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So the big question, 2 days later, we've had some time to think about it. What do you attribute Joe Biden's victory in this election?
Sure. Well, I think that the reversal in President Trump's fortunes is pretty stunning, because if you had asked me whether he was likely to win re-election in February, I would have guaranteed that with a high degree of certainty. Incumbents typically don't lose re-election. If you look at the incumbents who have lost re-election in the last 90 years, Herbert Hoover, Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, they were facing an electoral context that was much different than what we thought that Trump was going to be facing. Where in February, Trump was benefiting from a strong economy with GDP growth expected to be 2-3% in the election year, historically low unemployment, strong stock market performance, and his approval ratings were tracking in a way that was pretty similar to Barack Obama's as he trended towards re-election towards the end of Trump's third year in office. And then obviously all of that changed with the onset of the pandemic. Trump's mishandling of the pandemic hurt his popularity, pushed it down further into the lower 40s. And the economy experienced a catastrophic collapse, 14% unemployment in April, 33% decline in second quarter GDP. And so the end of the day, it's not really that surprising that a unpopular incumbent with a struggling economy would go on to lose.
So you're subscribing to what has been accepted over the years, that voters put more stock in the economy when they're voting than almost anything else.
Absolutely. I think that this election wasn't really about Trump versus Joe Biden. It was about Donald Trump and his performance as president over the last 4 years. Some political scientists have used the metaphor of a tug of war to describe presidential campaigns, where you have two roughly equally matched sides, and then over the course of the campaign, at some point, the rope will be pulled onto the left side. At some point, the rope will be pulled onto the right side. But at the end of the campaign, the side with the stronger natural advantages will pull that rope across towards victory. And I do think that's what happened this year as well.
But at the same time, I mean, I think everyone is aware that Donald Trump was probably the most unique president in the history of the United States. There didn't seem to be any gray area when it came to opinions on President Trump. Obviously, he had a great deal of followers who just loved him, everything about him. They liked the way he talked about his opponents, called it as he saw it. They really liked that. They thought the economy, as you said, was so strong before the pandemic, and he would bring it back. Then there were those who opposed the president and vehemently opposed the president, saying that they can't stand the way that we've had the chaos of the past 4 years, and that the president was a bully, and that he was dishonest, didn't tell the truth all the time. So with all that said, you still think that the economy would have been the major issue in this?
Well, I think to some extent, it's interesting to think about how this would have played out in another situation where the economy continued its strong performance to Election Day, because what you say is fundamentally correct, that Trump was the most polarizing president that we've had from day one. First day in office, 45% approval, 47% disapproval. And then his approval ratings over the course of his administration showed shocking stability, whereas most presidents are going to start high and then decline. He stayed at this point just in the mid-40s. And so maybe that would have made it difficult for him to get enough support, even with a good economy, if that had been the way things had unfolded, that maybe he couldn't get enough to win. But with a bad economy and the polarizing nature, I think it was always going to be an uphill climb.
Mm-hmm. Let's take some phone calls. And again, that's what we are encouraging today. We want to hear from you. Dan is in Reading. Dan, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. My question actually is thrown out to your audience of people who are probably Republicans that think that there's been cheating going on at the polls and in the counting. My understanding, and your person on today can probably clarify, most election boards are made up of both Republicans and Democrats. And so I don't understand how Republicans could say that there's cheating if, in fact, there are Republicans. And honestly, I know one of the people, they are some of the most honest people you could ever get. If there was ever a whistleblower, there would be this lady. But I just don't understand how they think that there's cheating if, in fact, both parties are represented.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your call, Dan. And Dan said that most are represented by both Republican and Democrat. All are made up of both Democrat and Republican. Dr. O'Connell, so far, there has been no concrete evidence of fraud, widespread fraud occurring across the country. So the point that Dan brings up, talk about that, if you would. This is something that the Trump administration, President Trump himself, has focused on, that he's been robbed, that the election is being stolen. And so far, there has been no evidence across the country that that has been occurring.
Yeah, I think the caller was absolutely right that the process is remarkably transparent in a way that we take for granted, with both parties being represented, observers being present on the sites, live streams available for the public who wants to tune in and watch the counting of ballots. If we look at data on the number of criminal convictions for voter fraud in the last 20 years, we've only got slightly over 1,000. We're talking about a handful of instances each election cycle. It's just statistically negligible amounts of voter fraud in the system. And so while President Trump certainly has the right to file these lawsuits, and there are procedures in place to address any problems that may have taken place in the vote counting, I've been incredibly skeptical that he'd be able to produce any evidence, because it's just not representative of the way the U.S. system functions. I think why you see these calls that there's fraud, that the election was stolen, as part of a larger concerning development in American democracy, where both sides are more and more reluctant to accept the results of elections that don't go their way. I was thinking recently about Ohio in 2004, which was the pivotal state that gave George W. Bush the Electoral College, where had Kerry won the state, he would have won the Electoral College by losing the popular vote by about 3 million. And that was a 100,000 vote margin, but there was a recount and there were calls to overturn the results. And if you ask Democrats, 2013 poll, almost 40% would have said that President Bush's supporters committed fraud to win Ohio in 2004. And so I think that we just really need responsibility on the part of leaders on both sides communicating what is true, that being the fact that America's elections are safe, secure, and fair.
And, you know, the point you brought up about recounts, has there ever been, I mean, you're a presidential historian, has there ever been a presidential race where a recount has made a difference? Beyond a few hundred, maybe thousand votes?
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. And I think that, you know, in terms of just looking at recounts across the United States of America, the only one that I can point to as being an important recount that changed a meaningful result is the 2000 Minnesota Senate race between Norm Coleman and Al Franken, where Coleman had a slight lead and then the recount, then Franken came out on top. But we're talking a couple of hundred votes here or there. In the states that President-elect Biden is leading Trump in, he has margins that are well above the amount that we would think could shift in a recount.
Let's take another call from Mike in York. Mike, you're on the air.
Good morning to both of you, and thank you to the guests for coming on. I just start by saying that I have a little bit of an interest in politics and political science. I was really struck by the vote splitting. I think to some extent this election was a recentering. You know, I'd sort of been in favor of Obama, but looking at the shift in a lot of how people probably reacted to a man of color being our president, Trump was probably, in a large view, a natural reaction in some fashion. And getting back to my first point, the vote splitting is really of interest. The fact that Biden won, but the Republicans did so well. And I guess in Pennsylvania, we've had this recent law change where you can't just check off either Democrat or Republican. And so that's an answer for Pennsylvania. I wonder why the vote splitting is happening in other places. Maybe your guests could answer that.
Hey, Mike, thank you very much for your call. And I have to agree with Mike that this is one of the more interesting aspects of this election. Dr. O'Connell, what do you think? I mean, I've read a couple columns today of, you know, pundits saying what this election has shown is that the United States is a center right overall, that we are center right politically. What do you think?
Well, I think that was another excellent question. I of course, want to see what the final data is in terms of the amount of ticket splitting. But we know that that has been trending downward since the 1970s and may have seen an uptick. And I do think it's a plausible interpretation that one of the reasons people were more willing to split their tickets is because they were cognitive Madisonians, that they were intentionally voting for balance in government and reacting to what has been often extreme politicking on both sides over the last 4 years. The other thing I would point out is, at least in terms of the president-Senate races, those senators that did well, that outperformed Trump, that's not entirely surprising because political scientists talk about something called the incumbency advantage, how incumbents are expected to perform in the Senate about 6 points better than a non-incumbent candidate of their party would perform in those districts, simply by virtue of being incumbent, because they have the ability to perform casework and constituency service and cultivate their own brands, which then makes them more popular, allows them to run for Congress by running against it. So incumbents are hard to beat. And the fact that the Democrats were trying not really to win open seats, but to beat sitting Republican senators, I think that it's not entirely unanticipated that those senators would do better than the president.
But at the same time, Biden didn't have coattails. I mean, usually the top of the ticket has some coattail effect, and he didn't have coattails here.
Yeah. Yeah, and in some in the House too, though, I think partly that's because the Democrats did so well in 2018, that the Democrats won all these closely contested seats in Republican-leaning districts. So how many more opportunities were there on the map legitimately for them to expand those margins?
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. 2 days after Joe Biden has been projected as the winner of the presidential race, we're talking about, well, what we're doing is getting your thoughts on the election, why you think Biden won, what you want to see during a Biden presidency, why President Trump lost, the split in the vote. Republicans did very well everywhere across the country, even though Joe Biden won. Think about all those things. We'd like to hear your thoughts. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Phone number 1-800-729-7532. Our guest is Dr. David O'Connell, Associate Professor of Political Science at Dickinson College. I got an email here, Dr. O'Connell. From Virginia, it says, as I was watching the news last night, several people in Harrisburg were lamenting that there was no way the vote counts were accurate and the count could not fluctuate as much as it did when the mail-in ballots were finally being counted. Interviewer noted the increase was due to counting the in-person ballots first, then the mail-in ballots, and the mail-in ballots were predominantly for Democrats because Trump told his followers to vote in person. It struck me that there was a point where it looked like Ohio was going to be flipped. Why? Because they counted the mail-in ballots first. The Republicans won Ohio by 400,000 votes, give or take. That's more of a comment than a question, but it is an accurate observation.
Oh, absolutely. And I feel that people really struggle to process these results, given that you saw this increase in vote by mail, absentee vote, early voting, and then you saw this partisan split in terms of the Democrats' willingness to use those ways of voting relative to the Republicans, and Republicans turn out more on election day. And so that you saw, depending on the way different states counted their ballots, misleading results early in the night or early in the week. But that doesn't mean that anything has happened that's untoward or fraudulent. It's just a product of state electoral laws. I would hope that coming out of this, states would critically examine the way they're conducting their elections, because you can have the ability to count votes before they come in, or before election day, rather, as they come in, like states such as Florida were able to do, and then they still were able to report results on election night and give people the certainty that things were conducted the way they should.
I never thought I would say this, but Florida seemed to have learned their lessons from 2000 and seemed to do it the right way. And you're right. I mean, as a bellwether state, as a swing state, we knew Tuesday night that President Trump had won Florida and actually won it pretty convincingly. Let's take another call from Barbara in Mechanicsburg. Barbara, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I just wonder if the Democrats did better with the presidential vote because so many people were just so against Trump. Even a lot of Republicans were against Trump. And also, if there was any fraud, it would have been Trump's fault because he messed up the mailing system so badly that when I sent a letter in August to Lewisbury, which is only about 15 miles away from here, it did not get there until October. So he himself tried to do fraud, as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, Barbara, thank you very much for your call. Dr. O'Connell, there are those who said that President Trump has been his own worst enemy during this campaign. And the changes made in the United States Postal Service and slowing down the mail is one of the things that they point to.
Yeah, and I think that, first of all, I think it's important to recognize that the changes that were proposed for the post office were developed by independent auditors. And you can read government accountability reports on the performance of the post office, that the post office has been struggling for a long period of time simply because of a decrease in the amount of first-class mail that the post office is carrying. The post office, even though it's an independent government corporation, is meant to be run like a business, is not really a business. They don't have the ability to simply close a post office because it's unprofitable. And so the changes that were being made, I think, are defensible given that the amount of money that the post office owes and their annual deficits continues to grow unchecked on a time when budget deficits and the accumulated debt of the United States of America presents a real fiscal challenge going forward. That being said, the timing of these changes was certainly not good for confidence in the electoral system. It looks suspicious that taking mail sorters offline or removing post offices, removing mailboxes, which can be defended in, say, January 2021, it doesn't look good when an election is coming and Democrats are more likely to vote by mail. And of course, Trump encouraged those beliefs by calling into question vote by mail and so forth. So I think there's just kind of two things there. There's one, was the post office part of some fraudulent scheme? And there I would say no. And I think the early indicators are that the post office did a good job getting ballots in on time, even though there were slowdowns in the late summer. And then two, it's how did people talk about this and how did it look? And that, for me, it's the perception question.
Yes, President Trump made a point of saying that Democratic voters wouldn't get their ballots that they needed so badly because of the slowdown in the mail being moved.
Right, but that doesn't mean that he had day-to-day control over what was happening in the local post offices.
Well, again, it provides perception that there was an effort there to slow it down. Let's take a phone call from Corrine in Lancaster. Corrine, you're on the air.
Good morning, Scott. I just wanted to say I think I'm actually echoing a couple comments, but I believe you can't claim this election was fraudulent if all of the down ballot races that were run by Republicans are valid. That would mean to me that the presidential election is also valid. It's coming on the same ballot. And I think what occurred was more a reaction to Trump's demeanor, tone, and lack of elegance, if you will, as the president.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you very much for your call, Corrine. Dr. O'Connor, you kind of have addressed that. Anything you would like to follow up on there?
Well, I think that that's certainly an important point as well, that if Republicans are going to claim fraud, then what does that mean for Republican success at state legislative races, House races, and at the Senate? It calls into question those performances as well. And so it's not a productive argument to make.
We have an email from Hannah who says, as a Democrat in one of Pennsylvania's reddest counties, I hope, and she's from Juniata County, I hope Biden's experience reaching across the aisle helps strengthen rural communities. Living in a place where masking is a political act, being able to count on typically civil, neighborly, rural relationships is at risk. I ask you to address what Hannah has to say, but also, when you break all the polarization down, this may be the biggest one of all, is the divide between rural and urban and suburban voters during this election. Would you agree?
Absolutely. It's just a major historic change. If I were to show everyone a scatter plot looking at the 1952 presidential race and charting county performance, looking at population density and vote for Dwight Eisenhower, you would see that Eisenhower, the Republican candidate, won many of the most urban counties in America, and he lost a lot of the rural ones. There was no linear relationship, but by 2012, you did see a strong linear relationship. The more populated an area gets, the more likely it becomes Democratic. And so that split has played out nationally, but it's also played out within states. And it causes real disagreement. And it also complicates the Democrats' chances of being a majority party in the U.S. Congress. Because right now, if we look at the congressional districts across the United States of America, over 50% of them lean Republican. They're lean Republican, which means if the Democrats are going to win control of the House, they have to win in Republican districts. They can't just win districts that favor Democrats. And often people say that that's due to gerrymandering, but gerrymandering really cements what's happening in terms of the geographic distribution of votes.
So President-elect Biden's, during his first speech Saturday night, he said he wanted to bring the nation together and that he would reach across the aisle and that he would be president for not just those who voted for him, but those who also voted against him. That was obviously a shot at President Trump. How does he do this with this great rural, urban, suburban divide?
Sure. It's obviously going to be difficult. I think that I loved hearing that from President-elect Biden because one of the things that I spoke of when I was on the program last week is that the actual political differences between Republicans and Democrats on the issues are not as large as people think, that they're definitely perceived to be larger. And instead, what we really have a problem with is effective polarization, the negative emotions that people have towards members of each party. And that's stemming in part from the signals that we receive from national politicians, that politics is war, that your opponents are your enemies. And so I think that kind of responsible leadership by Biden saying that he'll be a president for not just blue states, but red states, that he understands what it's like to lose an election. He's going to work for Trump supporters, even though they didn't vote for him. That's an important first step. But I would also say that bipartisanship for Joe Biden, it's not a talking point in a speech. It's not a public relations ploy. It's a real value he's committed to, that he's lived, that he has personal relationships with Republican senators that other Democrats do not, that he's spent time with Mitch McConnell outside of the chamber. And so I think that in terms of how does he do it, it's also encouraging that he's got some experience doing it already, indeed being the key emissary for the Obama administration to Republicans in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jim in Enola. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jim.
I want to make three points as quickly as I can. The first one is to kind of reinforce what your guest just said. Joe Biden wasn't my first choice for the Democratic nominee, but I think he's the perfect candidate for this time because he has a proven record of working across party lines. I was going to say just what your guest said, that he and Mitch McConnell used to do presentations together on how to work together. So that's the first point. The second point is Donald Trump is now irrelevant in my judgment. I mean, he's living in his own alternate reality. What is really important is that other Republican leaders step up and say the election is over and we need to try to work with the new president. And particularly I want to call out Senator Pat Toomey. He needs to step up. He's not running for reelection. He needs to say no more false narratives. We need to support, we need to acknowledge the election and try to work with this president. And others are Mitch McConnell and Mitt Romney. The third point I want to make is I want to call out the Pennsylvania legislature, because the reason why Pennsylvania took so long to count the mail votes is because the legislature refused to make certain changes, like allowing early tabulation of voting without releasing the results. Just the sort of stuff that they now have in Florida. The Pennsylvania legislature needs to step up and reform Pennsylvania's counting of mail-in and absentee ballots. So thanks for taking my call.
All right, Jim. Thank you very much. His first point you did kind of address. But when Jim says that he thinks Donald Trump is irrelevant, is he? I mean, I don't know if I agree with Jim on that one, because he still has his devoted followers across the country. So will Donald Trump be irrelevant?
Well, irrelevant's a strong word. Less relevant, I think, is absolutely true. But
well, yeah, he's not going to get the daily media coverage that he has for the last 4 years.
And that's one of the things that he's benefited from over the course of the past 4 years. I mean, his social media following is immense, but it's magnified by the fact that the media would run a front page story about anything that he would tweet, whether it was serious or not. And that type of additional influence will be diminished as he goes forward. But I do think, so one of the things the caller mentioned is that Republicans need to come out and acknowledge the results of the election, which I fundamentally agree with. Over the weekend, I was rewatching George H.W. Bush's concession speech in 1992 to Bill Clinton. And I would encourage listeners to go rewatch that as well, because it was just a remarkably gracious and classy acknowledgement of what was a difficult thing for Bush to experience, but it sent a good message for the country. And you know, Republicans have talked about how Democrats refused to accept the results in 2016. And there's certainly evidence to that effect. Gallup did a poll right after the election where 23% of Clinton voters said that they wouldn't accept Donald Trump as a legitimate president. And then that mushroomed into Democrats who didn't attend the inauguration, Democrats who refused to vote for any of Trump's cabinet nominees. And so Republicans, I think, have fairly complained about that. But if they want to see better behavior, they also need to model it. And so I think that starts with acknowledging the results. But here's where the connection comes between the two, because I think that the hesitancy on the part of some Republicans to acknowledge what is a clear win for President-elect Biden is that they're waiting for Trump to do so, that they're kind of hesitant to be out in front of Trump on this issue for fear of what might happen if then he would target them in response.
And Jim's third point about the Pennsylvania legislature with Republican majority, I think a lot of Pennsylvanians would probably agree with. They would definitely like to see some changes, had the opportunity for those mail-in ballots to be counted separately. Now, what happened there was Republicans put in a bill that would happen. Part of the bill also was that there would be no drop boxes and there would be some other things there that Governor Wolf wouldn't agree to. But after this experience, I wonder if there will be any changes for the next election.
Right. And so I mentioned that earlier in the program as well, that I agree with the caller on that point. I think that it's tough to change election rules in the midst of a political campaign. And so the likelihood that the legislature and the governor could get on the same page was probably low. But the hope would be that now that we're past that, in a new session, new year, that there could be a critical examination of what went right, what went wrong, and what changes could be made to improve the way election results are counted and reported.
We will be back with more phone calls in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lear.
Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about the election results, looking ahead to a Biden administration, kind of dissecting what happened on Tuesday and all through the week. Our guest today, Dr. David O'Connell, Associate Professor of Political Science at Dickinson College. He's the author of the book, God Wills It, Presidents and the Political Use of Religion. His research and writing has been published in or is forthcoming in Presidential Studies Quarterly, Politics and Religion, Political Science Quarterly, and White House Studies. If you have a question or comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf, and we are getting a lot of responses. We'll try to get to as many as we can. Let's go to the phone. Mady is in Harrisburg. Mady, you're on the air.
Scott, this is Nurbash. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Okay, very good. I respectfully disagree with your guess that if there was not a corona and economy was doing well, perhaps we had, Mr. Trump at the moment, was reelected. That argument trivializes the Americans' idealism for democracy, and this has been raised repeatedly. And from what we see at the moment and what we read from, you know, this election, a lot of people who came out and voted for Biden, they wanted to protect democracy. And this is something that, you know, especially in this election, we have to notice and we have to emphasize that for many, many people, the democratic institution, democratic values were endangered, and a lot of people, you know, came out to vote and change the course. That was overall, you know, my demand. Thank you very much.
Mady, hey, good to hear from you again. Thank you very much for being with us. Dr. O'Connell, democracy, a lot of people, let's face it, there were more people who were anti-Trump voters than pro-Biden voters. I mean, that's what the polls, okay, we'll talk about the polls in a moment, but that's what many people said, is that those who supported Biden, there was less enthusiasm for Joe Biden as a candidate as there was for Donald Trump. Plus, there were so many people motivated to vote against Donald Trump, maybe for one of the reasons that Mady mentioned, that they thought that democracy was in danger.
Sure. But I mean, this is all taking place in a context where you have seen the effect of the pandemic on Trump's approval rating and on the state of the economy. I just always look at elections as political scientists do, which is empirically, objectively, neutrally based on the data. And so the structural forecasting models that I rely on that use things like presidential approval, state of the economy, whether an incumbent is on the ballot, those models have been validated by years of correct experience. That the structural forecasting models in 2016 these are not using polls. They're using things that are known in advance that the candidates have little to do with. And those models always predicted a close race in 2016, separate from the polls and separate from the national narrative. So I think that the fact that those models would have predicted a strong run for Trump in February, we just have a lot of a track record that we have reason to believe in that data, in the accuracy of that approach towards understanding elections. The other thing is there was a mention of turnout. And so there is an argument that higher turnout favors the Democrats that you often hear made. And we had higher turnout this election, 67% of the voting eligible population, it looks like. But it didn't help the Democrats across the country. And so the research here is clear as well that non-voters in most states are slightly more Democratic than voters. But that's not every state. It's not true every election. And ultimately, you don't want to compare non-voters to voters. You want to look at how the addition of more people who are not participating to those who are already participating would shift the overall electorate. And if we simulate turnout up to 75%, you don't see a partisan consequence. This has been documented consistently in political science research. So that high turnout, I don't think, had much to do with the result either. I think that, again, the structural features would have predicted that Trump would receive about 47% of the two-party vote in the fall based on what we knew at that point, and that's ultimately what he did.
But do the models hold true for Donald Trump? And this is where I'm going to bring in the polls. For the second straight presidential election, the polls were off. I mean, there were people predicting a blue wave, Democrats dominating in this election, not just on the presidential level, but on the down ballot in Congress, the Senate, even on the state level as well. So do the models hold true? Maybe that Donald Trump is something unique. And why do you think the polls were off again?
Well, I think it's a little more mixed, I would say. So the national polls seem to have been reasonably accurate at the presidential level. That if at the end of the day, because Biden's margin is still going to grow, if at the end of the day, Biden wins this election by about 6 points, let's say 5-6 points, and the aggregate polls, depending on which combination you use, might have suggested an 8-point lead going into the election. That's not that large a miss. It's actually in line with historic misses. It might be even more accurate than in 2012 when the polls were off on average 2.4 points. At the state level, I think a lot of the polls will prove to be accurate. I mean, in states like Florida and Georgia, North Carolina, you saw evidence of a close race. The two states where the polls definitely were wrong would be Michigan and Wisconsin, where Biden had leads of approaching eight to 10 points, depending on the data that you were using. And so there are huge misses in those states that I think do need to be critically examined afterwards. In terms of the down ballot performance, I don't think we had a lot of data to necessarily be sure how that would go, because we're not seeing the kind of regular repeated polling that we see for the presidential race that would give us a real sense of what the state of the race was in a lot of these places.
Jeff asks, I'm curious what your guest thinks about a system of education that raises an electorate who relies on wishes and gut feelings rather than demonstrable facts.
In terms of voter knowledge, there are definitely some gaps, and that Americans' knowledge of the basic procedures of politics is shockingly low. And of course, there's a lot of evidence of people rejecting established scientific fact, whether it's related to the coronavirus or evolution or climate change or any other topic that you might want to point to. But I do think that we have a lot of evidence that voters can still make intelligent decisions just using shortcuts that are available to them. Low information rationality is what it's called. And having a shortcut available, whether it's party ID or an endorsement or simply observing the way a candidate ran their campaign, leads people to make the same decision that they would make with more information. That's what the research shows. And so I actually... And I think listeners are kind of getting the sense that I have a pretty optimistic take on the performance of America's political system in general. But I also have a lot of faith in the capability and wisdom of the American people.
Let's take a call from John in Dallas Town. John, you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. I have a question, but it is more of a comment than a question. The question is, 4 years ago, Trump ludicrously claimed that 3 million Mexicans were bussed into the United States to vote against him, and that is why he lost the popular vote. So how many Mexicans is he going to claim were bussed into the United States this year to justify why he lost the popular vote and the Electoral College vote? In my opinion, Trump is nothing but an ignorant, disgraceful liar, and all I can say is good riddance to him. Thank you for
your call, John, and good to hear your opinion. Let's go to Nicholas in Cumberland County. Nicholas, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, so my comment is this. The last time I looked, there were 74 million people who voted, new voters, and what we need to do is we need to find a way, especially the Democratic Party needs to find a way to keep them engaged and keep them activated, because, you know, they were this close to... basically overthrowing democracy in America. So we need to find a way to keep people engaged and, ensure that they remember that they were this close.
Thank you very much for your call, Nicholas. Point that he makes, Dr. O'Connell, what lessons should Democrats take away from this election?
Well, I think that's one fair lesson, to keep people engaged, that there's always this focus on turning out the vote for a presidential election. But one of the consistent things that political scientists would tell you is that people overestimate the importance of the presidency within America's political system. And if you really want to change this country, you've got to pay attention to the races that are less exciting, that draw less media attention, that you've got to get people engaged at the local level. For example, this summer, the protests against police violence, police misconduct, racial injustice, that Joe Biden's going to have limited ability to influence local police practices. If you want to have an impact on that issue, you've got to vote in mayoral elections and town council elections where those decisions are going to be made. So I do think that is one lesson. And I think another lesson for the Democrats is that they also need to find a way to make, and we talked about this earlier, appeal to people in rural areas and expand their coalition. And I think we've seen in this election that simply being against Trump isn't enough. And that if we look at the performance of Democrats among Latino voters, where Trump did better among Latino voters in Florida along the Rio Grande Valley, despite that constant message that Democrats made, that it suggests that you got to have positive appeals too. And so I think that's another lesson that I would offer for Democrats.
Let's go to Mitch in Chambersburg. Mitch, you're on the air.
Thank you, Scott. And thank you, good doctor. I have gotten to the point where I take huge umbrage at people talking about, you know, the radical on both sides. The policies that even the squad, the four alleged radicals hold, are very akin to what the Republican Party platform was back when Eisenhower was in office. The policies that FDR was able to come up with, and they didn't get it all right immediately, in the Great Depression, were hugely socialist programs. A bank that took over mortgages so people didn't lose their homes. The Glass-Steagall Banking Act of 1933 that stopped the speculators from getting hold of people's money and gambling with it. The Civilian Conservation Corps, the National Recovery Act that put people to work with government money.
Hey, Mitch, I'm going to have to cut you off because we only have a couple minutes left. Dr. O'Connell, what do you think about what he's saying and history?
Sure. So quickly, I do think that there is the general direction of policy that people on the left are promoting may be more popular right now. If we look at public mood and aggregate measure of liberalism and conservatism, it's as liberal as it was in the early 1960s right now, which is unsurprising because people move in the direction against the current administration. So you saw conservative policy and that sparked a liberal movement in response. But then that goes the other way, that people will be moving in a conservative direction again. And at the same time, some of the ideas that people on the left have promoted, like defunding the police or even Medicare for All, where support tends to dissipate once people are made aware of some of the trade-offs that would come with such a system, those aren't necessarily popular policies.
We had a couple callers that we can't get to. One, Marie in Lancaster, wanted to know if mail-in voting will continue. It seems that way. Don't you agree?
100%, especially as more people now are comfortable with voting that way, because voting for most people is a habitual act.
Also, Mike in York asked, and you've addressed this, but we'll ask it again, how long it's going to be before we see here from Republicans that this was a legitimate election. Mike says an illegitimate election, but a legitimate election.
Yeah, I think it's only kind of a matter of days. Over the weekend, you already saw people like George Bush and others coming out congratulating President-elect Biden. And I think people are waiting on Trump, but they'll only wait so long. The transition is already beginning.
Speaking of that transition, one thing that I noticed this morning, story out that the General Services Administration in the Trump administration has not signed off, which traditionally happens, for the new administration, for building space, money that is allocated to transition. So, you know, hopefully that occurs and that because it'll just make it a little more difficult and the Biden administration will have to wait a little bit longer for some things. But it seems like we're not getting a lot of cooperation there. Dr. David O'Connell, Associate Professor of Political Science at Dickinson College, quite an election year and a time in our history. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, while we've been talking so much about elections, COVID-19 has been raging again. Tomorrow's program, We want to focus on the latest with COVID-19 that's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in.